Welcome to the Functional Medicine Podcast with Dr. McMinn and Coach Lindsay. We're coming to you from McMinn Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, where Dr. McMinn is an integrative and functional MD, and Lindsay Matthews is a registered nurse and IIN certified health coach. In this podcast, we'll be discussing the latest information on a wide range of topics in the field of functional medicine, which looks for the root cause of disease, and integrative medicine, which incorporates both conventional and alternative therapies. Our overall goal is to help you be the best that you can be in mind, body, and spirit. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without approval from your personal doctor. And now, on to the show with Dr. McMinn and Coach Lindsay.
And welcome back to the Functional Medicine Podcast. This is Dr. McMinn from the beautiful Birmingham, Alabama. I'm here as usual with our amazing health coach and nurse, Lindsay Matthews.
Thanks, Dr. McMinn. Hello, everybody. It's so good to be back with you. We are super excited about our guest today, Dr. Suzanne Judd from UAB. She's a professor over there. And for those not familiar with that acronym, that's the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Welcome, Dr. Judd.
Thank you.
Good morning, Dr. Judd. And thank you so much for joining us on the Functional Medicine Podcast. Lindsay and I preach nutrition every day at McMinn Clinic. And we're from the old school of food is medicine. I tell my patients the number one thing you need to do for your health is to be mindful of what you put in and on your body. So we're really excited to pick your enormous brain about this important topic.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm looking forward to being here. It's great to be with both of you. And, you know, I admire both of you incredibly. So this is a wonderful opportunity for me.
I so enjoyed getting to meet you more personally a couple weeks ago. We had just a great conversation. I was so inspired just by your background and your traveling. So we'd like to kind of unpack a little bit about who you are. You've been a part of multiple research studies, which is so amazing. You not only live nutrition on a personal level, but you really can speak it from a deep scientific understanding. And you have this beautiful educational background as well, PhD from Emory, and you also have your master's in public health, also from Emory. You've studied chemical engineering at Michigan Tech. I mean, wow, this is an impressive background you come to us. We are so honored that you would share your wisdom with us.
Thank you. Absolutely. Yeah, that's I started out as a young person wanting to be a physician, and my personal physician was an engineer. So he encouraged me to do engineering because he said it'll set you up in a very unique way, which is why I did chemical engineering. But then when I graduated undergrad, there were so many jobs for chemical engineers that I started and went to Kimberly-Clark. And I worked for the Kimberly-Clark Corporation doing clinical trials. So I actually learned clinical trials from industry, not necessarily from graduate school, before I went on to do more work in nutrition and epidemiology, which is my master's degree. But I had always loved nutrition, even as a high school student. I played volleyball in high school and college, and I actually picked up a dictionary of nutrition and read it cover to cover.
Hello.
Because I wanted to be, you know, have the peak performance as an athlete, and I was getting mixed messages from different coaches and trainers and all kinds of folks.
Wow,
so I used a dictionary.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a former engineer as well, and I really admire engineers. They have a very special way of thinking and problem solving, and so they come to problems from a unique background. And also, I think it's really cool that you are a chemical engineer, because as we talked about earlier, life is chemistry, and nutrition's chemistry. And so it's really kind of cool that you have that background and kind of put it together at that level. But tell us about your current research at UAB. What are you studying these days?
So I do research on large populations. We have a 30,000 person stroke study right here in Birmingham, Alabama, where we're trying to figure out why there are racial and regional differences in stroke. And I was brought onto the study 11 years ago because diet was one of the big factors we were interested in studying. And that's most of my research focuses on how do you study diet in the large population. We all know how to look at it individually. We all know how to look within our own bodies. But when you have to make comparisons from one person to the other, it requires a slightly different skill set. So most of my studies are looking at characterizing diet in this 30,000 person cohort and other cohorts across the United States.
Wow. What a complex task to look at this whole population.
It is. And if you can imagine, it's important for listeners out there to think about what our tools are for analyzing people's diet. Think about yourself. If I were to ask you what you ate yesterday, some people could answer, but some people couldn't. Mm. It's very challenging. So we have to make sure that we're using good scientific methods to understand what people are eating. Is it what they eat regularly? Some people change their eating based on if they're at work or if they're at home. So we have to take all those factors into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So a typical day of study for you, like a typical day for you, I know you travel, you've lived in other places, but you're also studying here at UAB. Like, tell us what a typical day for Dr. Judd is.
Oh, yes. A typical day involves me going to the office and taking many, many teleconferences with people all across the country. But a lot of it involves looking at data as well, trying to see how we have analyzed our data. Even after we asked people what they ate, then we have to decide, how do we know what's in that food? A tomato grown in Alabama does not have the same nutritional profile as a tomato grown in Mexico. So we have to really think carefully about what is in the food that we eat and look through the databases that are available. And then I talked to a lot of my colleagues across the country to make sure that I'm staying up to date on the most recent methods and papers. I do a lot of reading. My 11-year-old, I tell him all the time, I basically read and write for a living.
Mm-hmm.
So I read a lot of journal articles as new science comes out and try to put it in context with the old science that was out there. That's a typical day.
Yeah, it does get very complicated, doesn't it? I was reading something quite a while ago about, and you can elucidate on this, a carrot today doesn't necessarily have the same nutritional value as a carrot maybe 50 years ago, right? Just because of soil depletion, things like that. An egg from a major hen house versus my grandmother's old barnyard egg may not be the same.
That's correct.
And we study things like, omega-3, omega-6 ratios and arachidonic acid, and we look at, was that animal from a major manufacturer, or was that animal from the barnyard? So I think that it must be difficult to do nutritional studies when you have to factor in food sources, right?
It is. Yeah. It is, especially the type of nutrition I do, mm-hmm. where I'm looking at the population level. We can control that if we put someone in a clinical trial and we tell them, here's what you're going to eat, mm-hmm. and we can control the food they eat. But when people are free living, it's really difficult to make those types of comparisons. Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about all these nuances about nutrition, but kind of stepping back to a big picture, we have the structure of this food pyramid that we've had around for, 40 plus years, and we've all trusted it. But then within more recent years, there's just been a lot of other information coming at us, and we've started to question that food pyramid and the validity of it. We've realized, wow, look at our population. We're overweight. We have type 2 diabetes out the wazoo. It's just an epidemic. And so now we have all of these bloggers and health coaches and nutrition experts and nutrition doctors, and we have information coming at us from all sides. We're inundated, and it gets really confusing. You listen to one person and you think, wow, that makes a lot of sense, and you might buy into that idea, but then you listen to the next one, and just as a consumer, wow, it's so vast, and how do we navigate all this?
And, you know, we have the paleo guys saying we should be eating more of a meat and fat-centered diet. On the other end of the spectrum, we have all the other folks advocating more of a plant-centered diet. So our patients and general public are left scratching their heads and very confused. So how do we sort that out?
It's challenging. It really is. There are so many different books that you can read, and there are so many scientists that will tell you what you should do. Honestly, Michael Pollan, who's a journalist, really summed it up best when he said, eat food, actual food that was grown or killed, mostly plants. Try to make 80% of your diet plants and not too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really a great summary that people could live their lives if you wanted to boil it down. There's no specific diet that's perfect for every single person. But any diet you follow, this is an interesting study. There was an interesting study published last year that they basically gave the participants a whole host of 7 different diet books, and they could pick any diet they wanted. Every single one works while they're on it. But if you can't sustain the lifestyle, the diet didn't work for you.
Right.
Yeah.
So paleo, vegan, pick whatever diet you want that works for you, that makes you feel good, that has your digestion working. The paleo guys, I joke with my coworkers, because I have coworkers, I should give my my bias. I don't eat a lot of meat. I'm pretty much a vegetarian. Don't eat a lot of dairy. Don't eat a lot of gluten. And I believe that works best for me. So maybe I'm a little biased in some ways, and it's important that people know that. But there are other people that would say you should eat all meat. And I have coworkers that would say you should eat all meat. And I always joke to them, well, do you ever go to the bathroom? Because if I ate all meat, I'm not sure I would go to the bathroom.
Right.
So it's, I think everybody has to decide for their own body what works, what they have access to, what they can afford. All of those things matter when you're selecting your diet, what you enjoy, what you're willing to sit down at a table and eat. That all matters, because it's actually, there's a big push in the nutrition field that I'm in right now to stop teaching people how to lose weight, because we know how to get you to lose weight. We don't know how to get you to keep it off. And we need to be focused on getting people to keep it off.
Right.
So insightful. How many times have we had that conversation?
Oh, yeah. So, gosh, over and over. Yeah, for sure. I've got this little handout I give to my patients. It's called the McMinn diet, coincidence, but basically whole food, real food, clean food, plant-centered diet. That's it, period. But it seems like there are a lot of these experts who support their recommendations with science, but it seems like, on the other hand, they kind of pick the science that supports their agenda. So tell us about sort of the science of nutrition and how we and our patients can sort through the constant and varied stream of information and find the nutritional plans best for each of us.
Absolutely. It's confusing. There's a different book out every week. Mm-hmm. There's a new article out every week, new clinical trials. So it can be very confusing. The key for people is to think about what the purpose of food is. And this really gets into one of the things I learned while I was in France. I spent 6 months in France living with French people in Bordeaux, which is the southwest of France, and watching the way French people eat. I think sometimes in the United States, we've lost our relationship with food. We're in a rush. We eat in our cars. We eat sitting at our desk. We race off with an apple in our hand. And the French don't do that. They don't eat. The only thing you might see them eating while they're walking are baguettes, because they just got it from the bakery and they take a bite of their bread as they're walking. Otherwise, they sit down to eat. And I sat with a group of French nutritionists, high school students, asking me about any question they had about the American diet. And, you know, the first question I got, is it true that Americans eat in between meals? That was the first question I got. Because they don't in France. Yeah. They don't eat in between.
That was such a foreign concept. Yes. They were like, is this novelty true?
Yes. Is it true you eat between meals?
Begs the question, are the French healthier?
They live longer. They have less cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
Similar rates of cancer,
but
they do have less cardiovascular disease.
Which is the number one killer of men and women in America, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So it depends on what you're trying to avoid in terms of chronic diseases. Yeah.
So a great example of that is the egg debate. Just last week, this big study came out, that eggs are bad for you.
Yeah.
Of course, before that, they were good for you.
Yep.
So tell us, that's a great example of science. And so tell us about this whole egg debate. I enjoy a good egg in the morning. So,
absolutely. Eggs are complicated. They, you know, in the 70s and 80s, when we really were trying to combat heart disease and we didn't have a ton of knowledge about the way diet interacts, it was very easy to get people to lower their saturated fat and cholesterol intake, which meant eggs and processed meats. And we could see their cholesterol profile go down, and we could actually, they would live longer before having a heart attack. Well, that somehow got changed into eat a ton of sugar. So then 90s, it became eat a ton of sugar, which I think that's when you saw some of the changes in the egg science. And now we've got people eating high-fat diets again, and you're seeing a change again with what the relationship is with eggs. At the end of the day, those studies are not clinical trials. They're again, what I do, cohort studies. They're not meant to be causal. It's not meant to say eating an egg causes death or eating an egg causes heart attacks. It's meant to look at what's associated so that we can then do clinical trials to verify what might be actually happening. But in terms of nutritional recommendations, an egg a day, you know, as long as you're not putting it with a lot of animal meat, especially like bacons and sausages that have preservatives and sodium, it's probably going to be okay, unless you have a genetic condition where you have really high cholesterol.
So the studies didn't factor out whether those people who were eating the eggs were also eating a biscuit and sausage and bacon and stuff like that as
well. And processed cheese and all those things that go often with egg consumption. Right.
So for instance, in that study, I would imagine those people who were eating eggs had a different sort of a diet overall than, say, a vegetarian.
Correct.
Right? Who would be eating much more plant-based.
Absolutely. And we attempt to adjust for that using statistical methods, but sometimes it's difficult to adjust for those things. So,
because there's so many factors.
Absolutely. There's so many factors, But in general, when you look at the U.S. population on a whole, because the U.S. diet, you know, there's an acronym, the Standard American Diet, which spells SAD.
Or the Modern American Diet, which is MAD. Right?
Yep, exactly, exactly.
MAD and SAD.
The French also consume eggs, in the forms of omelets and frittatas and all kinds of things. Quiches, the French do consume eggs. When you have a balanced diet, an egg here and there is not going to be terrible for a person.
Well, speaking of American versus French, what country has supposedly the best diet in the world? And like, you know, for instance, who less heart disease, lives longer, et cetera?
There are a few populations that are known to live over 100. There's an Okinawan population that lives, has extreme longevity. They tend to be primarily vegetarian. Seventh-day Adventists tend to live a long time. They also tend to be primarily vegetarian. In the Mediterranean, there used to be a region where there was a lot of longevity in the south of Italy and in Greece, and that's kind of where the Mediterranean diet came from, although that's changed quite recently. Mm-hmm. That's if you want to look at longevity, those are populations that live a long time. The things that they have in common is that they eat a lot of plant-based foods. Some of them eat a lot of fish as well, so there is meat in the diet, but they don't tend to have access to what we have with factory, you know, farm-raised beef and chickens. Even in France, it's the same way. Beef is not the primary meat on the menu. You're going to see goat, and you're going to see sheep, and you're going to see chicken and duck and all types of meats, where we tend to get just focused on chicken and beef in this country because it's so affordable here.
Yeah, it raises a lot of debate, though, doesn't it? I mean, how can you feed the world? I mean, we have this, you know, overpopulation situation. So, for instance, you seems like you almost have to have like factory raised, say, pork or whatever, to feed the jillions of people we have on this earth. Do you not? I mean, you can't go out and get wild caught everything and feed the masses.
Right.
Am I right?
Right. No. Yeah, you're right. That's where the challenge comes. Yeah. And at the moment, we're leaning toward meat, especially in this country. And we've taken up fields that used to be used for grains to feed cattle and pork, especially. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting debate that we should have as a society. Do we want to continue to do that? Or do we want to change the mix of the products that we have? Mm-hmm. But no, in this country, we focus heavily on meat. We have very cheap meat in this country. Yes. Very, very cheap meat.
We export it all over the world.
We do. We do. Mm-hmm.
So here at the clinic, we've always tried to have this evidence-based approach, but there's so many complicating factors, which we've kind of hit on a lot. That's been a big theme of this conversation. But, you know, here where we are in Alabama, gosh, we deal with cultural biases from living in the South, y'all. And then we have social economic factors that affect us across the world, really. But, you know, easy example of that is, you know, go buy a loaf of bread and the cheapest one on the shelf is that beautiful white Wonder Bread that makes you wonder what's in it, and versus trying to get like this beautiful maybe Ezekiel bread or organic 7-grain sprouted bread that's so much more expensive. So this whole cost thing and budgets and money comes into food. And then we have just kind of the food industrial complex, which is the marketing behind food. You take your kiddo to the grocery store and right on their eye level with the cart is all those beautiful, colorful cereal boxes and the marketing that's coming at our kids and us as adults. So there's all of these other almost like non-food factors that come in and affect food.
Mm-hmm. And even when you do want to eat well, in our society, we and our children are surrounded by badness everywhere you look. I had a patient just a couple weeks ago who was trying to eat better, and she was trying to lose some weight. But she said she had 3 birthday parties that week, and she went to each of them. Of course, they had cake and ice cream, not broccoli and carrots, right? And so she indulged, and needless to say, she put on about 5 to 10 pounds, and she was very disappointed because she was doing so well. But the point is, I mean, everywhere you go, you're in America, we're surrounded by badness, and it's very difficult to stay on task and to eat that whole food, real food, clean food diet.
We really have to kind of live with this intention to overcome these negative forces around us and transition to a healthier diet. What are your thoughts on this, Dr. Judd?
Oh, I think that's the biggest challenge that we face in this country. That we have food everywhere. Another thing my French colleagues noticed, they said, you know, those of them that had been to the U.S. and studied or lived at some point in time, they said, you guys have food everywhere. You know, people are bringing in cakes and donuts and cookies and all kinds of stuff, and it's just laying around. There's just food laying around in the United States, and you just don't see that in France. It's a little bit more expensive. Things like cake, they're more expensive, those processed foods. The whole foods are less expensive. So in the grocery store, you don't see aisles and aisles of processed food in France. But we haven't done that here. So you have to make a conscious decision as a consumer that you're not going to eat that way, that you're going to take a step back. I always recommend to people that I work with, when you know you've got a birthday party coming up, plan for it. Is there something that you can drink, or is there a hot tea? You know, walk in with your own favorite cup of hot tea that you can sip on while everybody else is eating cake. And to be very conscious after you eat that cake and ice cream of how you feel. Mm-hmm. Because if you start thinking about how you feel, you notice we have big slices too. Right. When they do have celebrations in France, or if you order your dessert, there are maybe 3 or 4 bites of cake. It is not a big portion, but here we have these huge portions that are 1,000 calories by themselves. Right. And if you stop after you eat it and ask yourself how you feel, it might make you less likely to go for that huge piece of cake next time.
Yeah, usually I feel terrible and I want to go take a nap.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
But sometimes I have to do that a few times for it to really sink in.
Yeah, absolutely.
and so then I'll be better for a while. Then I kind of forget how bad I felt. But anyway, I'm usually pretty good about it. But it seems like everywhere you go, you're surrounded by that. But it seems like in some cultures they can eat anything they want and stay thin. While some of my beloved patients, they say, "Well, doctor, I just smell good food and I gain weight." So they claim.
No, it's true, because they probably aren't paying attention to what they're eating. Mm-hmm. It's really tricky when you're constantly bombarded with smells and cues, mental cues. You know, I'm just as bad as everybody else, in particular with coffee. I really like to have a cup of coffee when I first sit down at my desk in the morning. And if I don't, there's something in my body that says you have to go get that cup of coffee. And I try to at least twice a year wean myself off coffee for 2 or 3 weeks to remind my body that it doesn't need it. But that cue, that cultural cue, makes you think you need it. And cake is the same way at a party, or donuts when someone's, you know, the last Friday of the month. Those cultural cues are really hard to push yourself and fight against.
This food conversation that we're having can be so personal for some people. I think, you know, when I think about food, for a lot of people, you talked about this relationship with food, that idea. And to me, so many of our patients, you know, food is comfort. We learn that from an early age when, you know, like if it's the bottle or the breast, here's your comfort. Food's also a reward. That's a huge conversation that I have with clients when I'm working with them. And it's so difficult for people to kind of change that fundamental way that they've lived their life for all these years, cut out the Cokes and the sweet teas, our Southern traditions, or change. You know, I think about when I grew up and I was studying, Mom would be like, "Well, if you finish your studying, I'll give you some power pills." And power pills were M&Ms.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
But it's ingrained. I still think about that when I see an M&M. I'm like, "Oh, there's a power pill." But it's just, food has such a strong ingraining. Like you said, that coffee, it's so guttural. It's so from your gut. Tell us about your personal relationship with food.
Oh, absolutely.
Give us some insight.
You bet. It was, like I mentioned before, I was a college athlete. And so I spent most of my, probably from the age of 14 until the age of 22, hypersensitive to what I was eating because I wanted to perform at my peak.
Yes.
And there were tons of things that I was being told. Don't eat anything with sugar in the first five ingredients. Carb load the night before a big tournament. There were many, many bits of information. But at the end of the day, I was probably burning 3,000 calories a day, so it didn't matter. When I got out of college and started my first job, it was very different to try to figure out how am I going to work out, how am I going to eat, and I wound up in a factory working really long hours in Paris, Texas, exposed to all kinds of foods I'd never seen in Michigan, trying to figure out what I was going to eat, and I got my first diet book where it said, you should eat six times a day. So I started eating six times a day, and I just gained weight. You know, I was just throwing more food into my diet. I started having a really unhealthy relationship with food, started having times when I felt like I needed to binge, and wound up gaining 10 or 15 pounds. Got out of that situation in the factory and went back and got my master's and my PhD and was able to get back in touch with my own body and how food made me feel. I went back to eating three meals a day instead of six meals a day. But I would tell anybody out there, if you eat six meals a day and can maintain your weight, keep eating six meals a day. Don't do what I did. It's important to know who you are and know what works well for your diet. Because some people really need to have regular meals in order to not over binge when they hit a mealtime. I think it's also culturally very challenging when we celebrate big meals. Another thing that I heard as I was talking to French people, we celebrate that feeling of overfull. Our biggest national holiday of Thanksgiving is the celebration of gluttony.
Yeah.
And we really celebrate that I'm going to sit and watch football even though I feel sick to my stomach. And it'd be great if we could turn the table on some of those arguments. You know, why would we want to celebrate being overfull? Why do we want to encourage people to eat more than they can? And it should start with our children. You know, we should, when we're teaching our children to eat, I think it's critical to tell them to stop when they're full and don't make them finish what's on their plate, to stop that hunger. We lose touch with our hunger receptor in this country. So people don't know if they're emotionally hungry or physically hungry. And it can really start in childhood where you let your child eat more free range and allow them to learn their hunger cues so they can really tell when they're hungry. If you watch a child, they very rarely will overstuff themselves. They just won't. So,
yeah. You know, I've had a number of patients who seem to do better on the frequent meals.
Absolutely.
For instance, when it comes to the obesity issue, a lot of your weight loss programs, the Weight Watchers, whatever, they'll encourage small frequent meals throughout the day to, quote, keep the metabolic engines stoked, right? Then if you go into this hunger mode, your engine shut down, you're not metabolizing as quickly. But I've had others who say they try that and they do much better with sort of intermittent fasting.
Yeah.
I think there's some good science behind that as well. So I guess it kind of boils down to each person and what works for him or her.
Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I actually, again, you know, personally, I do intermittent fasting on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
I'll stop eating for 24 hours just to reset my metabolic engine, but it works for me. And there are a lot of people who couldn't do it. So I think it's always important to ask yourself, if I tried this approach and then I wound up eating twice as much as I would normally eat, is it the best approach for me?
Mm-hmm. As I look around at the rates of obesity, and it's a big deal in our country and to many of my patients, and all the other badness such as diabetes that comes from poor diet and lifestyle, I'd love for you to share your thoughts on how we can move forward as a society using diet and lifestyle medicine to become healthier as a society.
You know, you heard me say it a second ago with children, but I really think it begins with children.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to bring back nutrition programs to schools.
Mm-hmm.
I think the benefit of the food guide pyramid was it was digestible, so people knew what the food guide pyramid was, and we could tell children what they should eat. But we need to have a message that probably is not the food guide pyramid. The USDA's new recommendation is My Plate, where you try to put a quarter of your plate as a protein, a quarter of fruit, a quarter vegetable, and a small portion of some type of grain. That makes it a little bit easier for children to understand. I think we need to have them cooking. Cooking should be something
yes.
we all celebrate and that we do together, and we teach children how you cook so that it's not a box of macaroni and cheese.
Yeah, that's a life skill.
It is. It's
so
a life
many of my friends got out and they just don't know how to cook. Yep. You know, that's so common.
Yeah, and I think one of the greatest blessings in life is sitting around a table with loved ones eating a good meal.
Yeah.
And yet we've lost that habit. You know, we're all eating on the run through the drive-through, and so yeah, getting back to that great pleasure in life of sitting around the table, having good conversation with loved ones.
Absolutely, that those things I think can really help us go a long way. I think it'd be great if we could just throw out all the fads altogether, and say don't read this book or that book, unless you know you're like one of us who just I love to read those books just because I enjoy reading what's out there, but I often don't change my diet based on what I read.
Mm-hmm.
I just look to see what the new science is and make sure that I'm still on the right path.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's very important we begin to address some of these issues because we're now seeing children obese when they enter kindergarten.
Yeah, it's awful, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we didn't see that historically. That's never been something we've seen. We're seeing strokes with people in their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Stroke used to be a disease of the elderly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, Dr. Judd, we're about to wrap it up. I wonder if you have any sort of take-home messages for our listeners.
Absolutely. The biggest take-home is that you are in control of your own diet. You can have a decent relationship with food again and love food without using it as a crutch. And then once you do that, you'll realize that truly plant-based, high fiber, high micronutrient like vitamin C foods that have those things naturally, they really help you to feel better. And you still get to eat a little bit of bacon here and there and eggs whenever you want to, but you've got to make sure your base is that high nutrient, fiber-rich food like fruits and vegetables and some of the more simple seeds and grains like quinoa or brown rice, things like that. That can be the staple.
Well, all right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Judd. That will about do it for this episode of the Functional Medicine Podcast. We hope we're able to share something with the listeners that was helpful for you.
Don't forget to check us out on the functionalmedicinepodcast.com, no the in front of that, and mcminnclinic.com. And please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. That helps us be found by other people and spread this information out there. Also, quick shout out to Ben Wedland, our recording engineer in the background. Thank you, Ben.
And now, drum roll please, Ben. Coach Lindsay, can you give us a Coach Lindsay pearl of wisdom?
Wow, thanks, Dr. McMahon. I think what I've just sat back and really heard today was just the concept of bioindividuality. That what works for one person doesn't always work for the next. But how do we navigate that? We've got to really work on our relationship with food and step back, appreciate the food for what it is and what it's doing for our body, but just allow ourselves time to eat with mindfulness. And what I work with my clients on, and I'd love to even hear your thoughts on this, Dr. Judd, as far as how you changed when you went from 6 meals down to 3, just the idea that take in the food with all your senses, smell it, look at it, appreciate the color, appreciate the people that you're sitting with, just slow down and chew your food. We've talked about those things before, but it just can't be underestimated. That's a life skill. We talked about cooking as a life skill, and eating is something we will do till the day we die, but we don't teach people how to eat, how to chew your food, how to sit down and appreciate a meal. Like you said, children kind of know that intuitively, and along the way, we kind of lose our sense. So any other tidbits on that idea of mindful eating that you want to share?
Mindful eating, and just be sure to get those fruits and vegetables in your diet.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and I often tell my patients for some people it feels like impossible to get from where they are to what we're talking about, and I tell them it's a process. You know, you kind of start simply and maybe start eliminating sugar and sweet tea and Cokes and stuff like that, and then just move in the right direction gradually. And it's a transition, but it does start with mindfulness and being mindful about what you put in your body. And going back to my pyramid of wellness that you can find on the website, I think the number one thing on the pyramid is what you put in your body. And so anyway, Dr. Judd, we're so grateful for you joining us and bringing your expertise to us. And so that should do it for another episode of the Functional Medicine Podcast. This is Dr. McMinn.
This is Coach Lindsay. Until next time, take care and be well.